key of the worshipers. Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together, because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Null. Today, how nut consumption during pregnancy is linked to improvement in neurodevelopment in children, from Barcelona Institute for Global Health in Spain. That is one of over a dozen articles from the peer-reviewed literature I'll be sharing today, how we can live a longer and healthier life. Then we're going to go to some commentaries. I have a commentary, and we're also going to share one from John Whitehead on D is for the dictatorship disguised as a democracy. We're also going to be having a mother and son on the air today, if time permits, sharing a unique experience they had. And someone who attended our retreat last week, we're in the last week of our retreat, a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, giving comments. And they say what they want to say when they're leaving on Friday. And so we'll hear from one of them. Because people say, what's going on? Well, I want to show you what's going on last week and the first day of this week. I just thought you'd find it of interest. So we have a lot to share. Time permitting, The Pathology of the Rich by Chris Hedges on Reality Asserts Itself. And what we didn't get to yesterday, Joshua Katz on the Toxic Culture of Educators in Education. Also, time permitting, there is a new article, and it's an interesting article. And I did not write the article, but I'm going to read the article. It's called The Damnation of the Man Who Cured AIDS. Interesting. And we'll see what it has to say and why it's important to understand this today, even though this occurred a long time ago. So we have a lot to share today. So we began, of course, with health and healing. And this is about nuts. Now, we know that nuts are known to help reduce the risk of hypertension, oxidative stress, and diabetes, and heart disease. And they have an extraordinarily protective effect against cognitive decline. The more nuts you eat as you grow older, the healthier your brain. So we have a long list of what we can say is good when we eat nuts. One article was published in the European Journal of Epidemiology, and it found links between a pregnant woman's diet, which is rich in nuts during the first trimester of pregnancy, and improved neurodevelopment in the child. And they took a look at 2,200 mothers, and they compared them. Mothers that ate nuts, 2,200 that did not eat nuts, and then followed that through to see on the maternal nut intake and what that would do to, let's say, the child years later. They test them at 18 months, 5 years, and 8 years after birth. This is a really good study. And they found that it improved cognitive function, attention capacity, and work memory. All that because the mother was eating nuts. I suggest walnuts, macadamias, almonds, pine nuts, filberts, pecans. Those are all good. Also, a study finds lifestyle factors that could harden arteries. This is in the University of Georgia. And they're telling us that one of the largest of its kind, a study performed an untargeted group of people, 1,200 participants, in this heart study to identify metabolites linked to hardening of the arteries. Remember, when your arteries are hardening, you won't feel it. There's really no symptoms. But the epithelial tissue, that's the lining, gets scratched and cut, and it gets little chinks in it. Boom, 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 boom. And those then can fall off, peel off. They can become hardened. They can then block the artery from the flow of blood, leading to high blood pressure. So hardening of the arteries or arterial stiffness is an independent risk factor for heart disease and death. And the mechanisms that contribute to arterial stiffness are not well understood. There were studies showing that the stiffer your arteries, the more likely you are to die. The more relaxed and soft and pliable the arteries, the longer your life. So that's important. And then they took a look at lifestyle. And they found this. They found that drinking coffee, drinking alcohol in any amount, southern foods, and for those of you who know southern foods, well, you have a couple different types of southern foods. You have the Tex-Mex southern foods. That would be down around Texas and Arizona and New Mexico. And those tend to be more of a Mexican influence and be very spicy and fried. But then you have the southern foods like Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Louisiana. Lots of fish, generally crayfish and shrimp, out of the Gulf. Again, fried, and gumbos, and which are not bad. Gumbos can be very good and nutritious. And lots of rice, lots of saffron rice. And that's good. And lots of fruits. But then you get into what we consider the Deep South. Florida, by the way, is not even considered South. It's a completely different construct when it comes to the multicultural food intake. People have migrated there but have historically not lived there. But you're talking about Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, West Virginia, Virginia, jump over to Kentucky. That's considered your primary South. And there the food is really, really unhealthy. Now, you can find healthy food, but more often than not, it's barbecued ribs, baby back ribs, pork pull, where they take a pork and they'll cook it for like 13 hours. And then they can take a strong, heavy-duty fork, and they just rake it across the meat, and it just pulls off. And then they smother that in some kind of, you know, really strong sauce, and lots of mashed potatoes with gravy. And gravy is nothing more than wheat flour with blood in it, cow blood, and they stir that around. It's watching it. It makes me. I'm a gourmet chef, and I don't ever make gravies like that because I watch how my mom would make it, and it'll bubble up, and it's just gross. In any case. Almost everything is fried. A lot of things are deep fried. So there you have the highest incidence of obesity and diabetes, the shortest lifespans in America outside of Native Americans. And so that's the deep southern food. And they're saying that southern food and lack of dietary supplements and pesticides all contribute to the hardening of the arteries. Now, you've known that, and I've known that. I've been sharing that for a long time, but I'm glad they're finally aware of it. So now, maybe they can start to go in and educate people about how their fork and their knife could be contributing to their health or disease. From St. Michael's Hospital comes a meta-analysis that finds soy protein reduced the bad LDL cholesterol, and that's good. Now, I suggest the organic, non-GMO soy, and you can take soy as soybeans. It's a great snack. You can make them yourself. You can take high-protein soybeans. By the way, a can of soybeans, which would make over a cup, not a bowl, but somewhere between a cup and a bowl, generally has upwards of 29 to 30 grams of protein. Almost all other beans have around 6 to 7 grams of protein. So you're getting a lot more protein in soybeans up to four and a half times more protein in soybeans. And what you do, you just open up a can of soybeans, rinse off the gel that's inside, and then just put it in a dryer, just a food dehydrator at 120 degrees overnight, and sprinkle some camocho, which is toasted sesame seeds, on them with some Himalayan sea salt, and then you have a delicious snack. You can snack on that at any time. It gives you protein, fiber, and the genistein and other phytonutrients that are in soy, and it's terrific for you. So you can lower the bad cholesterol by having some soybeans. Then, from Columbia University, a moody gut often accompanies depression. Now, why is that important, and how is it that we associate a person's mood, the brain, from your gut bacteria? Because you actually have two brains. You have neurons in the gastrointestinal tract, and you have them in your cranium, in the skull, in the brain. So for people with depression, gastrointestinal distress is a common additional burden, and a new study suggests that for some, the two conditions arrive from the same glitch in neuron chemistry, low serotonin. The study conducted shows that a shortage of serotonin in the neurons of the gut can cause constipation, and just as serotonin shortage in the brain can lead to depression. The study also found that a treatment that raises serotonin in the gut and the brain can alleviate both conditions. And that means having really good probiotics and supplying the gut with the probiotics that end up becoming the gut biome. And that biome is filled with hundreds of billions of good bacteria. Good bacteria from fermented foods, like sauerkraut and tempeh, tofu, miso, kimchi, any of these, even vegan yogurts have probiotics in them now. And even taking a bottle of probiotics, that way you're getting billions of probiotics per serving, and that helps the neurons. And then you end up having, and here's how it works. Just remember that the gut is the second brain. And that gut, your gastrointestinal tract, contains more neurons than the spinal cord and uses many of the same neurotransmitters as the brain. So therefore, the two conditions are very associated. The less serotonin you produce, the more depression you will manifest. And also, neurons are in the gut. Hard for people to understand that, but it's true. So by taking in quality nutrients, and you can also take in B vitamins, which help, you can take in phosphatidylserine, acetyl-L-carnitine, you can take in glycerophosphorylcholine, and that all helps the brain. But also, there's something relatively simple. It's a precursor to serotonin. So when I'm working with people with depression, more often than not, I ask them, how are you sleeping? Oh, I don't sleep well. I want you to start taking 5-HTP, hydroxytryptophan. That's a precursor of serotonin. And it works in part by increasing the number of GI neurons, and that ends up helping. So the discovery of this connection between a brain and gastrointestinal disorder suggests that 5-hydroxytryptophan, you can buy in any health food store, is a slow-release therapy. And that's what you want. So, this is neurogenesis in the gut. And that means we can correct it. That means if you've been drinking alcohol, eating sugar, refined carbohydrates, then you're not going to have a healthy gut. And without that healthy gut, you're not going to have healthy bacteria. Without that, you're not going to be able to correct the depression. So neurogenesis can help treat other types of conditions. It can treat constipation. And so the healthier the gut bacteria, you can have all kinds of good conditions come from that. Next up, Emory University researchers identify a link between zinc deficiency and hypertension. Now, zinc is one mineral that we need every day. There are dozens of things it does. So when you don't have enough zinc, then what happens is that you can increase your risk of high blood pressure or hypertension. And that occurs because zinc deficiency can change the way the kidneys process sodium. So get your zinc. You don't need a lot, 15 to 20 milligrams a day of zinc. And this was published in the American Journal of Physiology and Renal Physiology. And then you hear me talk a lot about phenolic, phenolic, O-L-L-I-C, two syllables. It's an acid, and its intake is associated with low risk of postmenopausal breast cancer. This is the University of Navarra in Spain. So findings reported at the European Congress on Obesity revealed an association between lower risk of postmenopausal breast cancer and a higher intake of the phenolic acids. And one of them specifically is known as hydro, H-Y-D-R-O, hydroxycinnamic, C-I-N-N-A-M-I-C. It's an acid also. They studied 11,000 female university graduates and then looked over 11.8-year average, and they found those that developed breast cancers and those that didn't. So when you're taking these in, where are you going to get it? Where are you going to get this hydroxycinnamic acid and chlorogenic acids? You're going to get it in grains, whole grains, your full fruit family, your full vegetable family. Hence, the more fruits and vegetables and the whole grains that you consume, the healthier you're going to be. Also, from the Umeria Training Hospital in Turkey, the Association of Bone Mineral Density, meaning how thick and strong and healthy are your bones, with vitamin B12. So it shows that if you got better B12, more B12, especially as you age, you're going to have stronger bones. It's that simple. Nothing complicated there. And also, betel leaf, B-E-T-E-L, offers an alternative to toothpaste with its antimicrobial properties. And this was done at Taylor University in Malaysia and Heriot White University in Dubai. The betel leaf is what is known as the Piper betel, and it's a heart-shaped leaf commonly used in India, mostly for oral health care. And the extracts of this leaf have recently become widely known for their ability to inhibit microbes, bacteria growing. And that's because the phytochemicals that are in the leaf. So by using this, even as a paste, massaging it around your gums, and I would use it with coconut oil. One of the best ways in the world to have healthy gums and healthy teeth and less bacteria is to take just a teaspoon of coconut oil. It's called pulling. And you massage that into your teeth. Now, if you have one of those little vibrating, what are they called? Oral B, and the little circular one. And you load that up with coconut oil, and then you could get some of this leaf, and you put the two together and just massage it around your gums for about 60 seconds. That would be terrific for your gums to lessen periodontal conditions. And again, I'll spell it for you. B-E-T-E-L. How's that? And it's common in India, so it's not impossible to get. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. We've got a lot of good commentaries coming your way. In fact, I'm going to share two things with you before we go to our commentaries. We have three different commentaries and a very interesting article. And we're posting the commentaries and the article today. And I have a four-part series I just finished writing upon what is wrong with Orthodox medicine and what it could do to improve itself and hence save us death and injury. And that'll be started on tomorrow's program. Plus, I have a brand new article I've written on the environment And this is a real eye-opener. I mean, of all the articles I've written in the last year on the environment, 9, this is the most revealing. That'll be later this week. But people say, what happens at a retreat? We're going to play you a testimonial right now so you can hear a person who was here last week.
Hi, my name is Michelle. What's up, New York? Hey, Uber drivers. That's what I do every day. I listen to Gary Noah at 12 o'clock or in my Uber, riding around, you know. I can't believe I'm here. And check it out. You know, I actually pulled the covers, okay? They say don't look behind the curtain because you might be scared of what you might find. So I look behind the curtain. He's real. And I've had a real nice time. And I've enjoyed myself. And I've smelled. Get out of New York once in a while. You know, he was telling us to smell and look and enjoy. Like these birds he got around here. I really didn't see them for the first 3 days. I swear to God. You know, and then something happened. I started looking at them and the colors. And it's just amazing. And then for you Uber drivers, there's something called a filter, right? For your car, you can just plug it in. You got to buy one. They told me about that, too. The food is good. I came here, I was a spoiled person. How could a poor person be spoiled? But I was, you know. I was like, wait a minute, where's my 3 meals a day? What's happening? And, you know, that saying that, you know, I don't live to eat. I eat to live. That's what's been coming in my head like all week. Like, I don't need this food, okay? You know, I eat just to live. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to eat 3 meals a day of junk every day, okay? All I need is enough to live. And, you know, I've heard it a lot of times, but I've never, ever really, really realized he's given us 1 meal a day. The first day, trust me, if I could have took a plane out of here, I would have. You know, and now I'm not hungry. You know, I'm really not hungry. I'm eating 1 meal a day. I eat fruit, okay? And I'm happy, and I'm really happy. I used to hear these things when people would talk on my radio, and I'd be saying, one day I'm going to go. One day I'm going to get there, and I'm here. So thanks.
All right, that was one person's experience. And yeah, we give 1 meal a day, a delicious, phenomenal, gourmet, multi-course meal, served in silence and eaten in silence. Takes an hour to eat it, and people really begin to feel energized. But all day long, they got protein shakes and up to 10 glasses of juice a day, and fresh fruit and watermelon, apples and grapes and peaches and plums. No one gets hungry. But they think they're going to be hungry. They think that, you know, I got to eat the way I eat at home. Well, what if at home you're eating wrong? What if that's contributing to diabetes and high blood pressure and cancer and obesity? So it's detox time, and we're doing it. Yesterday I was walking back downstairs from doing the radio show, and I saw some people standing there, and they seemed to be engaged in some serious conversation. So I went over to find out, how's everything going? Now, I've asked the mother and the son to come on the air to share some experience. But before they get here, I want to show you what actually is possible. We have someone on the phone who's been to the retreat. His name is Kenny. But before he came to retreat, he came to a brain support meeting. It was a meeting to see whether or not you could qualify for being in a study. The study was a year and a half long, and you had to have brain injury medically proven on meds for at least 3 years before you qualified to get into the study. It was a lifestyle study. There was no medicine, though it was medically supervised by a board-certified neurologist. One of the people who came almost didn't make it, because when I was doing the orientation on the first night, a woman came up and said, "I'm sorry, but we won't be able to attend." I said, "Why?" "Well, because my husband's got advanced multiple sclerosis, and I can't get him up the steps." And I said, "That's not a problem." So I said, "Let's go help him." So we went downstairs, and we helped Kenny up the steps, and every week we'd help him up. Today, Kenny doesn't need any help. He's on the phone now. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and you can give the short answer, and then you can tell your story. How many different neurologists were seeing you for your advanced end-stage multiple sclerosis?
Let's see. Well, in the beginning, it was just one neurologist. And then later on, I went to go check out two others, so three altogether.
So you had three board-certified neurologists?
Yes, sir.
And what did they tell you was the prognosis and the outcome of your multiple sclerosis?
Well, the first one is the one that gave the diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. And this guy sat me down and said, "Okay, there's really no cure for this. You really want to be proactive and go ramp your home because you're going to end up in a wheelchair. And that's really the best we have to offer you, aside from sending you to a clinic where you have to teach yourself to give yourself injections every day for the rest of your life." And then the other two that I went to were post, you know, my son's disappearing, just to ask them, "Okay, well, what's going on here? I haven't had symptoms." And basically, these are the two guys that said, "Hey, you know, I guess you never had it."
So you had end-stage multiple sclerosis. It was progressing over a number of years. You didn't have the full use of your arms. You had a lack of balance. You had less lack of muscle strength in your whole body. You were suffering from fatigue and other conditions. And then you came to the study group, and over 16 months, every single symptom reversed. And now your diagnosis is completely MS-free, cured, correct?
Correct. And going to that health support group was of my life.
When you were at the health support group, did you ever see anyone there who had their own conditions, like African-American gentleman named Thomas, who had full-blown Parkinson's disease, shaking like a leaf when he came in and completely steady-handed on his exit?
Yep, there's a decent handful really benefited from your protocol.
Do you remember the woman who had end-stage Alzheimer's?
Most definitely.
And what was the outcome?
The outcome, well, before you talk about the outcome, you have to first look at where she was. She couldn't do anything for herself. She couldn't dress herself. She couldn't feed herself. She couldn't take care of her or clean herself up after using the bathroom. And, you know, so she was completely, you know, at the mercy of whoever was able to help her out. So she went from that condition to being able to take advanced computer classes and being completely independent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so,
and do you remember her talking and reading on the very last day?
Yeah, I do. The change is just miraculous to see how people go from one to they come out the other side. I've experienced it myself. And every time I see other people at your retreats experiencing the same thing, it really inspires me. And I love seeing it.
Okay. Have you seen people with multiple sclerosis at other retreats reverse it?
Yes.
Did you see a 24-year-old African-American woman who could not walk 3 feet without falling over? And after 2 weeks, she walked a marathon 26 miles and had her full strength and muscle reflexes back?
Yeah, not only that, the thing is, you know, it's funny how the universe, you know, seems to connect all of us, because I'm in New Jersey and this person was local, and, you know, I spoke to her and she, you know, she said to me at one point that, you know, she wishes not to have her name mentioned or anything like that. But I saw her at something having to do with my daughter and I couldn't believe it. And she looked so amazing. she would have no idea that she came from, where she came from, you know, when we first saw her, and how she ended up. And I'm still in a tight communication with her right now. She's doing so fantastic. And you're absolutely right. She could barely walk. She couldn't even, she, one of her complaints was she could barely make it around a half to six block when she first came. And yeah, she's had a miraculous recovery.
Okay. Well, Kenny, remember, when people say something cannot be done because they haven't been able to do it, you and other people are living proof. But here's the interesting part. What do you think would happen if someone in your advanced end-stage multiple sclerosis, where you were told to start putting railings around your house and railings on a bed because you would end up first in a wheelchair, then in bed, and then gone? What do you think would have happened if they would have found a drug that would have cured that?
Jeez.
Think about any news? Think that would have gotten any health reporters' interest?
Guess what? That'll never happen.
You're right. It will never happen.
That's like
so
a,
all
a
the
unicorn.
People...
But it's a unicorn. You'll never see one.
Isn't it interesting that the people who are alive and well today and improved or cured today of diseases that orthodox medicine has not had any success with, they will never be able to give their stories because no reporter will be allowed to share that.
No, and it doesn't serve the corporate.
Yep. We're going to hear from Luann in a moment because she's tracked down the mother and son, and I want to hear. I don't know what they're going to say. We'll hear from them. So thank you very much for coming on, Kenny, and just reminding people when the people say something's not possible, they're right. But if you believe it's possible, you're right. Which right do you want to be? I appreciate your call, Kenny. Thank you. Now, while we're waiting for the mother and son to get on the phone, I think you'll find this very interesting. I want to share a story with you. It's posted now. And, I'm just told that they're on. Let's go over and say hello. What's your name, please?
This is Gilletta, and Quinnell is here as well.
Hi.
Tell us your story that when I came up to you yesterday... And you were crying. Everybody was crying. Tell us the story. And what's the results today?
Well, I'll start. This is Gilletta. We had an experience yesterday that was unlike anything. It was nothing short of a miracle. For the past 13 years, my son has been suffering with multiple sclerosis, 14 overall, but 13 very symptomatic. And one of the symptoms that he has that is one of the worst of them all, because it takes his sight and his ability to see clearly. Everything he sees tremors because his eyes tremor. And then he has other ancillary things going on as well, such as leg spasms and very severe tremors in his arms. Well, yesterday we had an opportunity here at Gary's spot. We were able to undergo some therapy that gave him not only the stillness from those tremors, allowed him to touch his beard for the first time. He's 31 years old, and he's been growing a beard for about the past 5 years and never had a chance to touch it because his hands would always tremor for the past 13 years. And he broke down in tears just being able to touch his beard without hitting himself in the face as he would do in the past. And the most miraculous of all was for 13 years, he saw everything as though it was vibrating. His clarity wasn't there. He wasn't able to see keenly, nor could he see colors keenly. And he just was able to, he said, Mom, I can see you and you're not moving. I knew you were beautiful, is what he said. And I broke down. This is just the most amazing thing. We have had hope and faith for so long. And, you know, after a while of dealing with something this symptomatic or something, when every day you wake up this way, I'm sure my son was losing some hope. He was holding on to mine for as long as he could, but I could see it in his face. when we arrived here for just, and that was the first day, might I add, the first day here, he was able to undergo that miraculous change, and his life has changed as a result. And he wants to just say a couple of words as well.
Gary, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Wayne and Colton. Like, the way you returned my essence of life to me, it makes me want to go back to school for architecture, because I dropped out because I could no longer write. I used to be right-handed, and the right hand would shake so much I had to drop out. But now I have hope, and I want to thank you.
We both thank you, Gary, from the bottom of our heart.
And how are you feeling today after that session this morning?
You know Tony the Tiger, right?
I feel yeah.
great.
Did you feel heat in your legs for the first time?
Yes, that really threw me off, because my legs are always freezing. Like, I mean, I hate to get too descriptive, but, well, I usually have to double up my layers on my legs because they get so cold. Not anymore.
And the how about even more today, Gary? We just noticed.
So you have less tremors?
Yes.
Yes.
So you can actually shake a hand before you couldn't?
How about that?
What else has happened in 24 hours?
Well, I am able to take clothes off and put them on more securely now, because before I had to stick my right hand out, and if it gets in the hole, it gets in. But now I can just throw my right arm through the armhole. It's like, whoa!
It's the little things. It's the little things that are major for him right now.
Well, having movement in his arms and getting his vision back, getting his tremors down, and getting his grip strengthened, and getting heat into his legs, these are all part of the process. So I just want to share your story of what you all found yesterday, because when I found you in the hall, you were all crying. I just want to let the people know what is possible in this world. They'll ask a physician, could you do this? A neurologist, have you ever done this? Have you ever seen this in anyone this advanced? Let them give you their answer. You see, this is from a different paradigm, a different understanding of the body, a different type of belief in what is capable inside of a human being. It's not mechanistic, it's not mechanical, it's not linear, it's not reductionist, it's not a mathematical situation. It's something far more intimate with the connection to life energies. So that's what happens. You've seen it, and this is just the beginning. All right? And we'll have you back on Friday when you leave, so you can tell what's changed for the rest of the week. Okay? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I thought it was appropriate to share this with you because a lot of people suffer, and sometimes we just have to know that there is hope, and giving hope to people is giving them strength. And the current medical model, at least 80% of it, doesn't have hope. only more the same. I don't tell people not to take the advice of their doctor. I don't ever tell them what to do, but rather I encourage a completely different type of energy. So it was interesting that at a time when I was featured in a New York Times Sunday Magazine feature, it was a good feature, there was a man named Harry Beal. Harry was a highly respected man in Israel. He was a benefactor. He helped them. He was philanthropic. He had been very successful in his life in academics, in intellectual discourse. He was a brilliant intellect, but he was dying. Came to see me. He had end-stage four different diseases, the most of which, because he was a smoker, was end-stage emphysema. And he had very high blood pressure and heart failure and cancer. And his request that day in the office in the early 90s was, could you just take away some of the pain? And I said, why stop with just pain? He said, well, because that's all that can be done. I've seen all the best doctors. I said, well, I have a different approach. Well, he tried my approach and reversed his end-stage emphysema, reversed his cancer, prostate cancer, reversed all these conditions. In fact, he came down at that time to Tioga, Texas, the Healing Springs Ranch, and he spent 3 months there. And during that three-month period, he went from not being able to walk 5 feet to doing a marathon and on a track and feeling phenomenal. And someone heard about it and interviewed him from the New York Times, and they took a picture of us, and it was in the paper. And that was very nice, you know. And I was, it was nice because I was glad to see that Harry's efforts at healing himself paid off. And that maybe it might inspire other people to understand, well, if he did it, and he's 85 or so, why couldn't it work with me too, even at a lesser age? At the same time this was going on, I was doing other work, helping a lot of other people, including with AIDS. A lot of people with AIDS, 1,200 people. But New York Times never interviewed me about that, though they were invited to by on three separate occasions, including physicians that contacted them saying, hey, why don't you go over there and see what they're doing? He's got an open policy. Take a look. But nobody wanted to know what we were doing. It was a we. It was a whole group of board-certified physicians, nutritionists, dietitians, Amar Gadol, the holistic dentist, psychologist, Dr. Donald Mullen from the Albert Ellis Center. I mean, we had a great team, almost 20 of us all told. And there were thousands and thousands of patients with all kinds of diseases, and I'm the one who created the protocols. Everything was based upon the protocols I created, and I was there every day working with people. Here is an article, after all these decades, it's published today, it's called The Damnation of the Man Who Cured AIDS. And I did not write it, and this is all independent research, but listen to it. And it'll be posted. Quote, well before 1981, when the Center for Disease Control reported that San Francisco resident Ken Horn was identified as the first confirmed patient with AIDS, members of the gay community were already exhibiting in large numbers symptoms that would later be attributed to AIDS and HIV infection. During the 1970s, a hard partying with recreational drugs and unprotected sex became a way of nightly entertainment for a small group, very small segment of the gay community, perhaps 2 or 3%, as well as a very small percentage of the heterosexual community, i.e. swingers. Signs of a serious immune-compromised illness were appearing. This lifestyle became known as fast-tracking. Gay men would consume large quantities of alcohol, experiment with a wide variety of drugs, including the over-the-counter drug amyl nitrate, popular known as poppers, and could have sex with multiple partners in a single night. Nights out could go into the wee hours of the morning, and many men were seriously sleep-deprived and malnourished. Following a day's work at the job, this nightly routine would then start all over again. As one of New York City's most listened-to radio broadcasters and experts on emerging natural health and alternative medical therapies, Dr. Gary Nall had developed a large network of relationships with physicians and health practitioners who regularly listened to his program. Consequently, before mass public fear over AIDS arose, Nall became deeply aware of the unusual symptoms appearing within a growing number of gay men and swinging heterosexual men and women who were seeking private physicians for medical attention and treatment. One of the more common symptoms was the life-threatening opportunistic lung infection, pneumocystis cranii pneumonia, or PCP, that was attributed to individuals with weakened immune systems. PCP is extremely rare for people with normal immune functioning, the illness usually associated with patients on chemotherapy or other drugs known to depress immune function. Usually it appeared in children undergoing cancer treatment or leukemia. Therefore, when PCP was being reported among otherwise healthy adults, a red flag was raised that something was awry. During the worst years of the AIDS epidemic and the highest rate of deaths in the 1990s, Dr. Nall treated 1,200 individuals with AIDS-defining symptoms. They were largely done through the Tri-State Healing Center that Nall founded on Manhattan's Upper West Side. As public awareness about the therapeutic value of alternative approaches to health and wellness increased, a number growing of individuals and groups within the scientific community were calling attention to the benefits of an integrative approach to AIDS. The alternative AIDS health scene was being born at the Tri-State Center. Although there was no recognizable overlap between Dr. Nall's natural protocols and the drug-based HIV treatments that hold dominance today, Nall's results cannot be denied. Regardless whether the private medical industry and the health federal agencies refuse to recognize a drug-free therapy or not, if such a treatment is shown to produce positive results, it cannot simply be explained away as pseudoscience or quackery. Yet opposition and disdain were the responses that Nall and many other physicians and healthcare providers using alternative means to treat early AIDS patients had to confront. As the official voice for the health of the nation, the CDC, the FDA, and Health and Human Services Agency have it within their powers to create mythologies, complacency about real national health threats that we should otherwise seriously be concerned about. They also have the means to generate exaggerated hysteria. A recent example is the 2019 measles outbreak and the government's urgency to vaccinate the entire population. Suffice to say, there have only been 11 deaths from measles infections during the past 19 years. The last recorded deaths from wild measles were in 2015, and both patients had other pre-existing and severe immune-compromised health conditions. On the other hand, there are over 450 reported deaths due to the measles vaccine recorded in the CDC's Veris database during the same period of time. For certain, the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and 90s launched an enormous scientific research and discovery effort to identify how the body's immune system operates when challenged by a serious and largely unknown viral infection. As a result, today we have a far greater understanding about the immune system. Unfortunately, the pharmaceutical approach to treating viral infections, notably HIV, has been single-minded and has adhered to a one-size-fits-all course of treatment. Antiretrovirals, the drug therapy, is little more than a horse race to kill a virus before it kills the body. In the case of early HIV antiretrovirals, it was additionally a race as to whether the virus could be defeated before the drug killed the patient. When the first signs of what would eventually be termed AIDS were appearing in physicians' offices, patients also frequently had other co-infections aside from a weakened immune system, including hepatitis B, non-A and B hepatitis, which Dr. Bill Rutter at University of California, San Francisco would eventually sequence and identify as hepatitis C in the mid-1980s, and cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, Coxsackie virus, mycoplasma, and yeast infections, herpes 1, 2, and 6, syphilis, and gonorrhea. They were also being prescribed medications like candies, like antibiotics and steroids, in addition to recreational drugs. And these were debilitating conditions of the patients due to a new virulent strain of one of these other infections, or was it something completely new? Nobody knew for certain before the French Nobel laureate, Luc Montagnier, at the Institut Pasteur, identified a virus that was named later the LAV and then renamed HIV as the likely causative culprit for AIDS in 1983. But before the arrival of the first antiretroviral drug, AZT, in 1987, physicians and health practitioners were forced to prescribe only the treatments in their medical toolboxes. Orthodox doctors were the least successful. Suffice it to say, it was an effort performed in the dark. Although heralded as a hero in his discovery of HIV, Luc Montagnier would eventually become a pariah for breaking away from the politically correct interpretation of the HIV infection. He argued that far too much attention was being focused on HIV virus rather than investigating other cofactors and other viruses, bacteria, and especially mycoplasmas within cell walls that may be amplifying HIV's effect. After tracking a group of HIV-positive and AIDS-free patients for 10 years, Montagnier stated, quote, "We can no longer say that HIV infection is always a death sentence," end quote. He concluded that a person could be HIV positive for their entire life and not develop AIDS because the virus does not act alone. He also suggested these mycoplasmas, often smaller than other bacteria and often harmless, may become virulent from the overuse of antibiotics, which create killer mycoplasmas. During an interview, Montagnier noted four factors that contribute to HIV's AIDS-like symptoms when they come together: the presence of the virus, HIV, hyperactivation of the body's T-cell receptor immune response, the presence of other sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, gonorrhea, and cancroid, and behavioral patterns acting as cofactors that may include poor nutrition, overconsumption of alcohol, recreational drugs, and physical and emotional stress. One important cofactor is oxidative stress, which Montagnier observed, quote, "in higher free radical production in stage 2 in HIV infection." Although Montagnier supported the antiretroviral drug regime, he also felt antioxidant supplementation was essential. His later research included the evaluation of complementary natural protocols, so he began to look at N-acetylcysteine, beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, superoxide dismutase, various plant extracts, and homeopathy. He also was on record for emphasizing the enormous role healthy nutrition plays for warding off AIDS-like symptoms while being HIV positive. When asked by filmmaker Brett Lewin in his documentary House of Cards whether HIV could be gotten rid of naturally, Montagnier replied, quote, "I would think so. It's important knowledge that is completely neglected. People always think of drugs and vaccines," end quote. However, long before Montagnier came around to question the AZT strategy as the only effective treatment, Gary Null and his colleagues had been utilizing antioxidant therapies as a primary defense in treating AIDS symptoms for over a decade. By 1985, the demand for a drug to treat, and then I'll skip this because this goes into the failed AZT test, the fraud of AZT, how many people die because of AZT. But I'll go, and then Wikipedia setting this, wow, boy, did they get this wrong. Quote, Wikipedia notes that AZT is, quote, "the most effective and safe medicine needed in a healthy system," end quote. The World Health Organization lists it as one of, quote, "essential medicines of our time." And then it goes on to talk about the actual warnings and the fact that its own creator found all these terrible life-ending symptoms if you use it, and in fact, you could hardly tell the difference between HIV symptoms and AZT symptoms. And even the manufacturer admits on the package insert, quote, "AZT causes AIDS." Let me repeat that. This is on the manufacturing insert package. AZT causes AIDS. Quote, "It was often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with the administration of a retroviral or AZT from underlying signs of HIV disease or intercurrent illnesses." And yet Wikipedia is saying it's a safe drug. Boy, they got that wrong. Now, I skipped down the article, which you can read for yourself, and it talks about humans. There was a story in here. It's reported. And he went through the protocol I have and completely reversed his AIDS. He's one. And then there were others. And then what they did. And then the Concord study where 1,749 patients over a three-year period who took AZT died, and only three people who were HIV positive but didn't take AZT died. 3 from the placebo, 1,749 from AZT. And yet it didn't stop the media or the people from building on one and denying anything else. So now it gets down to where I was working, quote, I was working with a doctor, Gary Null was working with Dr. Stephen Chiesa, a gay New York City physician who had been struggling to treat persons with severe AIDS symptoms since the late 70s and were employing whatever means they could. During the peak years of mortality in the early mid-90s, Null was treating 1,200 patients, none who've died. And at that time, I didn't follow him after that, so I don't know. And then it goes on to talk about how we began to see the reversals of full-blown AIDS and HIV seroconversion, and how that was what happened for years. And all told, when you read the article, you will see that there were a total of 18 individuals who seroconverted, meaning going from positive to negative, all symptoms gone, completely healthy and normal. Their medical records, every month or every 2 months blood chemistries from Roche laboratories, all of that was meticulously documented. And anyone who wanted could come in and talk with the medical staff, and if they were a physician or a nurse or a scientist, they could talk with the patients and with the patient's permission see their records. And the word got out, and it got out because of a African-American journalist, highly respected within the African-American community, Doug Henderson, also an attorney. And he was there for his own health conditions, and while there for his non-AIDS health conditions, over a period of months, he began to talk with the people who were there for AIDS. And he was so impressed with this, he asked permission, could he see the records, and he did, in the blood chemistries, and he took it to Bill Tatum, the African-American publisher of the Amsterdam News. And then he came in and over a period of months interviewed the patients, looked at the records, and then he wrote a story, and or Doug Henderson wrote a story for the Amsterdam News. Then Errol Caldwell, a former New York Times reporter, came in, and Tony Brown, and he sent a whole group to investigate over a period of months. And Bill McCreary, multi-award-winning African-American reporter for Channel 5, was there for months, because they were all afraid they didn't want to bring anyone on the air and be made a fool of. So they had absolute irrefutable proof. And then I was invited on the air, and they wanted me to come on with patients who had reversed AIDS, and we did. And it got so much that a whole group asked, could I do a lecture at the Apollo Theater? I did 3 sold-out lectures at the Apollo Theater on AIDS. And the room was filled with African-American physicians who were treating their patients now with new protocols. They were visiting us on a daily basis. And here's the bottom line to this. You can read their stories. You can read the testimonials. One of them is from a Dr. Avram, a senior scientist in cancer research, and who said, quote, I witnessed and reviewed the records of 10 HIV patients who null seroconverted to negative. From her experiences working in Zimbabwe and observing the results of antiretroviral drugs like AZT on AIDS patients, made her conclude, quote, there's a lot of people who first had good results, but after that they collapsed because not only were the drugs not controlling the virus, but it was also depleting the last of the immune system that was left in them. That's just one of many people on the record currently. Evidently, these people were interviewed in the last few weeks, and this investigation evidently had been going on for a year to bring all these people back, including former patients, still alive. David is one of them, still alive, quote, after having been diagnosed with advanced AIDS 1988, treated at the Tri-City Healing Center with my protocol, and completely seroconverted. So this is a story that was not told. At the same time, the New York Times told the story of a man who was dying, Harry, of emphysema. So think of that for a moment. You're allowed to tell the story of a man dying of leukemia, of emphysema, who reversed it and is vitally healthy in his late 80s, but you can't tell the story of reversing AIDS. And instead, no one in the media told the story, except the African-American media, except the African-American medical doctors, except for the African-American reporters like Earl Caldwell, Bill McCreary. Tough and exacting an objective journalist, so the story was never told until today. Now it's posted. You can read it for yourself. So the next time someone decides to attack and say, oh, AIDS denialer, understand they've got an agenda, and the agenda at the bottom of it is nobody wants to know how to treat a disease that costs nothing when they can give you drugs and make $800 billion thus far profiting from this. Yeah, HIV is real. AIDS is real. But boy, should we have looked at the politics and the profiteering off of this condition. So finally, someone wrote an article. And it's there. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening and have a nice day.